Well, listen to that. A marching band straight off the top. Let's chuck in some fireworks as well. Speakola is having its 50th episode. Well done, me. An idea from April of 2020, a lockdown idea, to start interviewing people about the speeches that I put up on the Speakola website. There have been 49 episodes so far, 131,419 downloads at 2,682 downloads per ep. So it's been embraced to an extent, and it's certainly been a lot of fun to make, and I hope it'll be a great record of great speeches and interesting guests across the spectrum. Not only that, Speakola website is 7 years old this month, so it's celebrations all round. And if you want to help me celebrate, you could leave a rating or a review or a birthday message or a little note of thanks at the Apple iTunes page for Speakola. And I think that helps people discover the podcast. If you tell someone, actually send a link to the show and send it to a friend who you know might like an episode. Social media is pretty much dead for us creators nowadays. You can't promote or link or get people to discover your work through social media. So pretty much rely on people forwarding links and using word of mouth. So tell someone about Speakola. And the third thing you could do for us is to subscribe and fund the thing. And you can do that either at Patreon, patreon.com/Speakola, or you could become a member through the Speakola newsletter on Substack, and that's news.speakola.com. And I think we're up to 5,700 free subscribers there, of which around about 150 are generous payers. And thank you very much to those people. I've got an excellent 50th episode coming up. The special guest is Dr. Brendan Nelson, who was leader of the opposition here in Australia in the Kevin 07 era. He was leader of the Liberal Party. Before that, he was defence minister in the Howard government. And before that, he was head of the AMA. But the feature speech that we're drawing on today is from his tenure as the director of the Australian War Memorial, a job he held from 2012 to 2019. And while he had that gig, my friend, fellow Hawthorn supporter, Limo, saw him deliver a speech which he's told me is the best speech he ever saw. And he said, you got to feature that in an episode. It's a beauty. And so I am. And I thought that given Limo was in the room for this speech, Limo should be in the room with us when we do the interview. So for the first time, or the first time in a long time, there's three of us in the conversation. Brendan Nelson, Limo, and me.
We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields.
If you lay down with dogs, you get fleas.
Fraud, sham, and hypocrisy. Change within the system.
The hollow man of anger and bitterness. All must be left to a bygone age.
I understand victory. I understand sacrifice.
Speakola.
I may not get there with you, but we as a people will get to the promised land.
With Tony Wilson.
Well, we are having a special episode here of Speakola. It's the 50th episode, and I've got a co-host for the first time. It is Anthony Limo Lehman, the star of Utopia, a regular MC on the circuit, and it was in his MC travels that he saw a brilliant speech.
I did indeed, Tony. Thank you for having me. I've been an ambassador for an organisation called Soldier On for many years, an organisation that helps to look after wounded warriors, largely from our recent forays into the Middle East. And they had their first ever gala ball in Canberra, I think in 2014. I'm actually guessing a little bit. It may have been 2015. And it was a fantastic night in Canberra. The who's who of Australian politics were there, including prime ministers, former prime ministers, defence ministers, heads of army, etc. And as part of the evening, there was an auction to help raise money for Soldier On, and the auctioneer was rolling through a few auction items, and then the auctioneer just moved on to the next auction item and said, all right, next up, we've got this painting of the Battle of the Neck can we start the bidding? And someone yelled out an initial bid, and then your next guest here, Dr. Brendan Nelson, jumped up. And Brendan, I hope you can recall this as clearly as I can, but Brendan jumped up and said, whoa, 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 hang on, hang on, hang on. Before you start the auction, can I just give a bit of background on this painting? And then, Brendan, you got up and delivered what was, for me personally, the most extraordinary speech I've seen live. It was unbelievable. And there wasn't a dry eye in the house at the end of it. And it came with an extraordinary twist around the frame that that painting sat in. And it certainly stayed with me. And I hope you can remember that speech and that night as clearly as I can.
I do remember the night, and I think it might have been 2015. I have been a supporter of Soldier On since its inception, and I am also an ambassador for Soldier On. And I had actually donated the framed, very high-resolution print of George Lambert's painting of the Battle of the Neck for the auction. And it's exactly as you described, Lemo, that the auctioneer had started but not really explained the provenance of the painting nor the framing of it. And that's why I thought, I'll bugger it, I'll jump up here and interrupt proceedings.
Yeah. And I'll tell you, and we were glad you did, because the speech which Tony is going to play, which isn't the exact speech from the night, but it's something that roughly replicates it. But what isn't in the bit that Tony's going to play, and perhaps I'll let you tell the story, is the about the frame of the painting.
Well, the story of the Battle of the Neck, and it's interesting, at the Australian War Memorial, there are 4 million items in the collection, from postage stamps right through to a V2 rocket and a Lancaster bomber and everything in between. I have 5 most meaningful relics or artifacts that I regard as the most significant. The first of those is the bullet-ridden Ascot Gallipoli landing boat, which was found by the official historian and of the First World War, Charles Bean, when he went back to Gallipoli in early 1919. But a very close, very short distance from that boat is a painting in the Australian War Memorial by George Lambert. And what happened was, in the northern part of the Anzac sector in August 1915, there were a series of battles that had been planned to break the stalemate. And for the New Zealanders, it was at Chanak Bear, which was their most famous and yet most tragic battle of the Gallipoli Land campaign. They had 900 dead. But 2 other coordinated parts of that breakout were the Battle of Lone Pine, which began on the afternoon of the 6th of August 1915, and then at 4:30 in the morning was the Battle of the Neck, the charge by the dismounted Light Horse. And so the connection between the two battles and what Lemo's described as happening at the Soldier On Ball and fundraising for wounded young veterans and their families. The connection is that, firstly, at 4:30 in the morning, as I said, of the 7th of August 1915, 4 waves of dismounted Light Horse would attack the Turks in a vitally important part of that sector, and the Turkish lines were only 20 to 60 metres away from the Australian trench. The Australians would do a frontal charge, and the first 2 waves were the 8th Light Horse from Victoria. The 3rd and 4th waves were the 10th Light Horse from Western Australia. The commanding officer of the 8th Light Horse since January 1915 was a man called Alexander Henry White, Lieutenant Colonel. He was a maltster, a beer maker from Ballarat, and he loved the men of the 8th. And he volunteered to lead them in the charge. The official historian, Charles Bean, criticised him for doing that. But Philip Schuller was the Melbourne Age correspondent, by the way, who would subsequently go on later in the war, enlist and be killed himself. And Schuller was there to observe and record what happened. And he said Alexander Henry White shook hands with his fellow officers. And then he stood down in the trench on the fire step. The artillery bombardment of the Turkish lines had largely gone over the Turkish lines and had finished early, 10 minutes early. And so in that eerie silence, as the Turks tested their machine guns and rifles, Alexander Henry White stood on the fire step with his watch in hand, and he said, "Men, you have 10 minutes to live, and I will lead you." And Shuler said that when the whistle blew, they all went over, and White advanced only 10 paces before he fell. Of the 300 officers and men under his command in those first two waves, 153 died with him, another 80 were wounded. And then they had tried to stop the attack, as characterised in the Gallipoli film. And Major Antill from Brigade Headquarters had simply said, "Push on."
Yeah.
The Western Australians from the 10th Light Horse filed into the trench over the dead, the dying and the wounded. Trooper Harold Rush, 23 years of age, famously embraced the man next to him and said, "Goodbye, God bless you, Cobber." And that became the epitaph for his headstone. The two men stood, held hands and said a prayer. The men removed their wedding rings, wrote last notes, pinned letters to the inside of the trench, and again they all went over. And Charles Bean observed Gresley and Wilfred Harper, two young Western Australians who had enlisted together at the outbreak of the war, who had consecutive enlistment numbers. He recorded them and Wilfred Harper racing to his death like a schoolboy in a foot race. Lambert's painting characterises these men as if they were marionettes that had their strings cut, that were falling. And when Charles Bean went back to Gallipoli, he didn't come back to Australia straight after the war. He instead went back to Gallipoli and he took a historical party early in 1919. And George Lambert, the artist, was amongst them. And he said, "When we got to the Neck and to Lone Pine, so thickly clustered were the bones, it wasn't possible to pass without treading upon them." He said the area resembled scattered thin white snow. And around Alexander Henry White's remains, skeletal remains, were found two things he took to his death. One was a gold locket on a chain within which was a photograph of his wife, Myrtle, and his infant son, whom he called Young Bill. And the other was a Bible. And within the Bible was a poem. And the poem said, "Let me be a little braver when temptation bids me waver. Let me strive a little harder to be all that I can be. Let me be a little meeker with the brother that is weaker. Let me think more of my neighbour and a little less of me." Now, the frame for the print comes from the lone pine tree at the Australian War Memorial. So the origin of that tree is that after the assault at Lone Pine, which, as I said, started at 4:30 in the afternoon of the 6th of August, 1915, 4 days of subterranean anarchy and killing. At the end of it were 7,000 Turkish casualties, 2,300 Australian casualties, 7 Australians were awarded the Victoria Cross. But one of the men who went in that first wave, a man called Benjamin Smith, spent 4 days looking for his brother who went over with him over the top from Lone Pine on that afternoon, and he couldn't find him. So he took a pine cone from the Turkish trenches and he mailed it back to his mother in Inverell in New South Wales, Mrs. McMullen, and she propagated 3 seedlings from that lone pine, that pine cone, and she sent one of them to the Australian War Memorial Director, a guy called John Trelaw, in 1929. The memorial had been conceived, but it hadn't yet been built. And she sent it to him as being her son's tree and that it would one day be planted at the War Memorial. So in every 6 months, Mrs. McMullen would write to John Trelaw and ask, "How is my son's tree?" which was at the Yarralumla Nursery. So in 1934, Trelaw's got the Duke of Gloucester visiting the site where the foundations had been laid. So he's thinking, what am I going to do with the Duke of Gloucester? I know that woman's tree. He can plant the tree. So he did. And so in 2012, a lightning strike hit the tree at the memorial and a limb came off it. And the groundsmen were about to chainsaw up the limb, and one of our staff ran out and threw herself over the limb and said, "You're not touching it." And so what the memorial did was actually mill that limb into some timber. And so I had that George Lambert print for the Soldier On auction framed in lone pine from the lone pine tree. Wow. The whole thing's very moving, Anthony.
It's an extraordinary story that you tell so beautifully. And then, Tony, it may come as no surprise that I think the first bid went from $1,000 to about $40,000 after Brendan gave that preamble. But it's a truly amazing story, and you capture that sacrifice really well.
And Ben, what about the print itself? George Lambert, what was his story? Was he there as part of the RAF earlier on, or was he a professional artist who was brought in by Bean later? What was his story of getting to Gallipoli and doing this painting?
Well, part of the key things in life, Anthony, is to be imbued with the imaginative capacity to see the world through the eyes of others. So we've got to think, we have to imagine, what was it like in the second decade of the 20th century? So here's Charles Bean, the official war correspondent who would become the historian appointed, who lands with the Australians on Gallipoli on the 25th of April, 1915. He stays at the front with the Australian through the entire war. He's wounded three times, refused to be evacuated. He was witness to the whole thing, from the Gallipoli landing to the Hindenburg line and the armistice, the whole thing. So he's thinking to himself, how on earth am I going to explain to Australians what these men and the nurses have endured on behalf of our young nation? So one of the most powerful things then, as it is today, is art, the power of art. So he chose George Lambert, who had a reputation already well-deserved for both landscapes and portraits. And he appointed him as an official war artist to actually come with him, not during the war, but immediately after the war, to paint the landscape of Gallipoli. So one of the most iconic paintings our nation has is the Gallipoli Landing by George Lambert, which hangs in the Australian War Memorial. And another one is, of course, George Lambert's The Neck. So he took Lambert to get and gave Lambert the commission to give Australians a sense of the terrain that had to be first beaten and then a sense of the tragedy and the sacrifice made by Australians. So a phenomenal artist.
And you mentioned in the speech, in the longer version of the speech that I'll play from the Howard Oration, you mentioned the young man running to his death as if in a sprint. And that really resonated. You also talked about the Weir film, the Gallipoli film, and the way those charges were depicted in the film. But that image, which is very much the Archie image at the end of Gallipoli, that iconic freeze frame, is that character based on an actual WA athlete?
It is. Well, firstly, he wasn't an athlete. So Gresley Harper and Wilfred Harper were brothers. Gresley was 31 years old and Wilfred was 25 years old. And like, if you like, the cream of Western Australian society at the time, they immediately enlisted when the war broke out in August 1914. And they went with their horses to Perth to enlist. And so, of course, the horses weren't taken to Gallipoli, so the light horse were dismounted. And so those two brothers were in that fourth and final wave that I described in the attack at the Neck. And at the end of the battle, both of them were seen dead at the Turkish lines. In other words, they got to the Turkish lines. As I said, they're only 20 to 60 metres away, but it was a suicidal attack, as you well know. And Charles Bean described Wilfred, the younger of the two brothers, as racing to his death as if a schoolboy in a foot race. And such is the sense of naivety and courage and selflessness on behalf of our young nation that these young men so willingly gave their lives. And Charles Bean reflected on the Battle of the Neck and wondered why these young men had been, if you like, prepared to give so readily give their lives. As I said, Alexander Henry White had actually said to his men, "You have 10 minutes to live, and I will lead you." And one of the, miraculously, a man called Sergeant Cliff Pinnock, he survived that first wave. He was in the first wave, the 150 that went over. And he wrote to his parents just a week after the battle, and he said, "Roll call was the saddest. 47 of 550 answered the call." And he said, "I cried like a baby."
Yeah. It's extraordinary. So of the ones that survived, presumably they were all injured in some manner, because if they had made it to the Turkish line, I imagine they couldn't have survived beyond that.
Absolutely. So in the end, of the 600 that went over, there were 370 dead and wounded. And you can only imagine the impact on those who physically survived. And, of course, those men went on to fight in subsequent battles on the Gallipoli Peninsula and then back into Palestine or off to the Western Front. Unbelievable.
Well, Dr. Nelson, to hear you tell the story, you almost have a word-perfect recall on the story. I mean, I've heard it in different capacities, and I'm interested, as a director of the War Memorial, how did you teach yourself to have these anecdotes? Because I think people do connect to the stories, the individual stories of war, more than the general horror of war. And you seem to have a knack for telling those stories. Did you set yourself a task when you got the job? I'm going to know these people's stories and I'm going to be able to tell them.
Well, you don't realise what you're learning when you're learning in life, and you don't really appreciate what's shaping you into become the person that you are. So for me, my father was adopted. I don't know his family background, but my mother's father and my maternal great-grandfather and their brothers all fought in the First and Second World Wars. My maternal great-grandfather was in the 12th Battalion, enlistment number 24. He was in the first wave of the Gallipoli landing and ended up in the Australian Flying Corps, survived the war. He had six sons, all six, including my grandfather, fought in the Second World War. So that shaped me in part. Then when I was practicing medicine, I went into hundreds of homes and I would often see the images of young men and women in uniform looking out into lives that had never been lived. Then, as you well know, I became Minister for Defence. That changed me in ways I didn't really appreciate, of really understanding what's important in life. And then I was Australia's ambassador to NATO and the European Union and Belgium for 3 years. But of all of the things I did, it was the time that I spent in the cemeteries in Flanders, in Belgium, and at the Menin Gate that were the most meaningful to me. And I didn't know what to do when I came back to Australia. But when I found out the job at the Australian War Memorial was available as the director, I immediately applied for it. And I'll tell you, the headhunter interviewed me twice and told me I wouldn't get an interview because I'd never run a big cultural institution. And it was only Julia Gillard as Prime Minister who intervened to tell them to give me an interview that I got an interview. And so this is a long answer to a short question, but I come back to Australia from Brussels to be interviewed by this panel. And one of the people says to me, "Dr. Nelson, do you know much about museums?" And I said, "No, I visited a few." He said, "Have you ever run one?" And I said, "No, of course not. You know I haven't." And he said, "Well, why on earth would we consider appointing you to run the Australian War Memorial? We've got all these people that have run major cultural institutions. We've got two that have run big international cultural institutions." So I said to them, I said, "Well, if you're looking for an expert, my first piece of advice is not to. But secondly, I've learned something about experts." And as I said to them at the time, I think there are about 300 people work at the War Memorial. They're all experts. They've forgotten more than I'll ever know. I said, "But I've learned something about experts from my time in the medical profession through everything I've done since. They see the world through a straw. And the key task in this, and I've been in this situation before, is to not just manage the institution, but to be a leader of it and ambassador for it. And the key job is the exercise of intellectual rigor to the process of exercising judgment, drawing on expertise inside and outside the institution." So everyone else on the panel put their pen down and went, well, they're nodding. So what happened with some trepidation, I come to the War Memorial, I've got these experts, I've got these historians, I've got these people that have got 3 degrees in how to hang up a picture, all of that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
So for the first couple of months, I'd have these VVIP tours. you know, I'd have the president of a country or the prime minister of a country or something. And I'm taking them on a tour, and I'd get to something and I'd hand it over to the historian to tell them, let's say, the Battle of Lone Pine. And I'd see the historian tremble, you know, wonderful people. And I could see them trembling. And the reason they're trembling, because they've got an encyclopedia in their head and they're trying to work out what, you know, how they're going to download it. So after a few months, I thought, no, I can do this. And then what would happen is, so if I had a speech to give somewhere, I would ask the staff, for example, to give me 10 stories. Let's say it's Lone Pine. Can you give me 10 stories of men who fought at Lone Pine with different outcomes? So they'd give me 10 stories, and I would choose one of them for a speech I'd have to give. And sometimes the historians would say to me, and the researchers, they say, oh, that's interesting you chose that one. That guy didn't do much. And I felt like I was walking through a paddock with other people and I was the only one that could see the diamonds. And I'd say to them, look, I love yous all, but you've got to understand normal people are not actually interested in a battalion went here, a platoon went there, the machine gun had this diameter of bullets coming out of it. They want to know, who was this person? Who did this person love? How were they loved? Why were they in these circumstances? And what did they do that was extraordinary? And I was always looking for stories that would move people and open their imaginative capacity to see the world through the eyes of these men and women and what they had done for us. So I realised after a period of time, in fact, I did the Dawn Service Address at the War Memorial in 2016. And when I give speeches, I don't read them, I just speak, I like to speak. And when I stepped back, having finished, the Vice Chief of Defence at the time, Rear Admiral Ray Griggs, he leaned over to me. He said, Brendan, I just worked it out. The best thing about you is you're not one of us. Yeah. He said, we could never say what you say about us. And it's an interesting thing, you know, because I'm very committed to these men and women, the Defence Force, the veterans, their families, but I'm not of them. And I can observe things that others don't. And it's interesting, as a non-expert, I often see things that I think normal people will engage with that story. So,
I think it's true. Because I've met a lot of ex-service men and women as well, and they'll tell you a story that to them is just very matter of fact. It's not necessarily a big deal to them, but as an outsider, I hear the story, and to me, it's extraordinary.
Can I tell you?
So they have a very different perspective being in amongst it, whereas they don't appreciate that we sit in our, you know, offices or wherever we do our work, we have a very different perspective on some of the incredible things that they do. And certainly when you go back to World War One and World War Two, it's incredible acts of bravery. But incredible acts of bravery in our recent, in Iraq and especially in Afghanistan as well.
Yeah, they certainly are. And it's interesting, we've recently marked the anniversary of the Battle of Long Tan. And one of the things I say to young people in life, you've always got to have an open mind, a mind that's open to new ideas and people that are unfamiliar. And the thing that's most going to affect you will happen when you least expect. So in 2006, I'm Minister for Defence. I'm walking through the shopping centre in Mount Gravatt outside of Brisbane with the then member for Bowman, Andrew Lamming. And in the crowd, someone grabbed my elbow. Someone was holding my elbow. And I turned and I looked, and there was a man who was quite disheveled. And he said to me, he said, Dr. Nelson, my best mate was Kenny Gann. He was killed at Long Tan. Can you do what you can to remember him? And then, as if to explain himself, he said, I was run over by a tank. And he just disappeared into the crowd. So then 10 years later at the Australian War Memorial, it's coming up for the 50th anniversary of the Battle of Long Tan. So with the last post ceremony at the end of the night that we do every day, which I'd introduced in 2013, I said to the staff, they said, oh, well, we should tell the story of this man for the last post ceremony. And I said, no, there was a man killed at Long Tan called Kenny Gann. Could we tell his story? They said, oh, well, yes, he was cool, but he didn't do anything remarkable. I said, no, I want to tell Kenny Gant's story. So basically what I learned was this man was 21. He was a conscript. He didn't agree with conscription. His mother didn't agree with it, but she said later said he wasn't a coward. Anyway, about 10 days before the 18th of August 2016, I get a phone call from a guy in Brisbane. And he says to me, Dr. Nelson, I understand you're going to tell the story of Ken Gant at the last post ceremony on the 18th of August. I said, yes. He said, do you realise that Kenny fancied himself as a singer? I said, yes, I do. We've got that in the script for the story. He said, do you know that the day before he deployed to go to Vietnam, he hired a recording studio and he recorded four songs for his mother? I said, really? He said, yeah. He said, I've had it. It's very scratchy sound, but I've had it put onto a CD. Would you like me to send it to you? I said, yeah, okay. So 3 or 4 days later, I get this disc. I'm sitting at my desk. I put it in the computer. And then I just hear this, the crackly noise you get on the vinyl, old vinyl records. And then I get this voice, unaccompanied, beautiful young voice of a young man singing Danny Boy. We played it at the ceremony. So you see what I mean? Like he wasn't a Star of Gallantry recipient or a VC recipient or anything. He was like us. He was just a normal young Australian who did what his country asked, and he got killed.
It's incredible. But I was wondering, you mentioned that ability to really communicate is what it comes down to, and to speak, but that also that ability to see the people around you. Can you talk a little bit about your mum and dad and your school and maybe the thing that breeds this in you, this ability with words and skill with communication?
Well, late last year I published my biography and memoirs of life and of leadership. All of the royalties go to legacy and to Lifeline. So it's not a money thing for me, but the answer to it is in there. It's interesting. I always say to young people, you will find it very hard to achieve and fulfill your potential unless you can learn to communicate effectively, whether it's to five people or to 500. And I didn't ever have any formal training in media or communication or anything of the sort. My father was quite articulate and my mother had very strong emotional intelligence, and I thank them both for those gifts respectively. But what happened in the late 80s, I was practicing medicine in Hobart with David Crean, late Simon Crean's brother. And we were running an emergency medical practice, and I was angry with the government at the time, and I was angry with the Australian Medical Association. So I decided to get active in the AMA. So I started going to meetings of doctors at the AMA, and I'd listen to people giving speeches. It was the first time I really paid much attention to it. And it was pretty simple. I sat in the audience and I knew what I liked listening to and I knew what I didn't. And I would look sideways at people and see how they were responding to what was being said and how it was being said. And one of the reasons I was angry with the AMA, because it didn't seem to have a leadership that could communicate effectively to Australian society. So in the early days, I started to write. So then I got elected into office at the AMA. I became the state president in Tasmania, and I found myself having to give speeches. So I started writing speeches. Because I was so busy running two medical practices and doing this AMA stuff, I didn't have time to write speeches. So I'd ask someone to do some research for various topics, and whenever I was reading something, if I thought it was interesting or valuable, I'd write it down or I'd remember it. And so I started writing my speeches, just handwritten notes on a bit of paper. And then for a couple of years, I'd take the piece of paper up and I'd go through what I'd written. And then I realised after a period of time, once I'd made some handwritten notes, I didn't need them. So, and I learned, particularly when I got to Parliament, when I worked, John Howard was my Prime Minister, Howard very rarely used any speaking notes. He wasn't necessarily giving the best speeches that you'd ever heard. Some of them were outstandingly good, but others not so strong. But I noticed that the response that he got from his audiences, because he wasn't reading anything, was far more positive than it would otherwise be. And so I learned the discipline of being able to simply speak. I'd think about, and to this day, I think carefully about what I'm going to say. The hardest part of a speech is starting and finishing. And people will always remember how you made them feel. They may not remember what you said. If you're lucky, they'll remember three things that you said, but they'll always remember how you made them feel. So tone is as important as what you actually say.
Yeah, I think the speaking without notes, because I do a lot of corporate functions these days, and I do stand-up comedy, which I, of course, do without notes. But when you don't have notes, it just you're expressing yourself so much more naturally. And it's got to come from your heart when you're speaking without
that's
notes.
That's the other thing, too. You have to believe what you're saying.
Yes.
So there has to be an authenticity in it. And part of the problem in politics, when I was a cabinet minister, for example, when I was leader of the opposition, almost all of what I said I believed, but sometimes I'd actually have to go out and run a case of something I argued against in the cabinet that I didn't actually believe. But really believing what you're saying is really important. Tone is really important. And what I do is when I get up to speak, I always will recognise the key people that need to be recognised. And then I will often tell some self-deprecating humour. Very early on, I learned you're a professional comedian, Lemo, but people like me should not be telling jokes, but certainly telling some humour at your own expense. I do that, and I'll often pick up, I always try and arrive early at an event to talk to people before I sit down or before I'm speaking, because inevitably I'll pick up something that's kind of funny from someone in the crowd. And the reason I do it is, the two reasons I do it is, firstly, I'm making sure that I've got the microphone and the sound right before I start on the speech itself, because the first sentence I'm going to make is going to say will be something that will make them listen. The second reason I'm telling some humorous stuff is because I'm wanting to make sure I've got their attention before I start the speech. And as you know, you'll have audiences where people have had a few drinks or they're not really interested in you, they've got no idea who you are, couldn't care, their boss has told them to come to this lunch or something like that. But I find if you're telling something funny, then other people at the table will say, hey, can you shut up for a minute? Listen to this.
So that's
how I operate.
And can you share, we promise not to be too well listened to and spoil your speeches, but can you share your go-to self-deprecation? Is it to do with not becoming Prime Minister? I think you're the only Liberal leader this century to not be Prime Minister, something like that.
Yeah. Well, yes, there are a number of them. I have funny anecdotes. And when I was Leader of the Opposition, my wife and I were going to a dinner one night, and then on the way to the event in the car, in this tone, she said, "Is this going to be a good night, or are you giving a speech?" and then another one was, I was Minister for Education, and I was asked to give an oration in honour of one of the pioneers of the engineering profession to Engineers Australia. And 500 engineers and their partners at the Hyatt in Melbourne for a dinner format. And I was asked to give a 40-minute oration. So I put a lot of work into it. I read Herbert Hoover's biography, The Work of an Engineer, Life of an Engineer by way of background, The Roebling at the Brooklyn Bridge, General Sir John Monash, etc. And I actually wrote this oration. So I did what had been asked, and I get up and deliver this 40-minute oration over this dinner format. And I always say to people, if you've got engineers in the family, you know them, they're pretty serious people. They need to get out a bit. And when I finished, I go and sit down, and the very earnest chief executive leans over and says, "Dr. Nelson, I do apologise for continuing to eat whilst you began your speech, but your wife said I should enjoy something while you were talking."
So that's good stuff. So nice to bring. See, I'm often using my wife as a in a bit of self-deprecating gear as well. Yeah, it's a good tool. Yeah.
Look, Brendan, before I finished, I thought I know you've advocated for Indigenous Australians really right through the AMA days when you were fighting hard for improvements in Indigenous health. You were one of the members of the Liberal Party who really stood up in the early Hanson era and said that, you know, we have to stand up against this, and I think that's to your credit long term. And then you were the opposition leader who delivered the apology speech alongside or on the same day as the famous speech from Kevin Rudd. You were there giving a speech as well. And the current Liberal leader, I think, also quite famously wasn't in the chamber that day. Have you been giving speeches about the upcoming referendum? Can you share your thoughts on it? Where do you think we're at with the relationship? I'm just wondering if you could give us a comment there.
I haven't. My current job, I'm based in London, and I am a member of the Executive Council of the Boeing Company. I'm president of Boeing Global. I oversee Boeing's entire operations outside the United States. So my company does not take a position on the voice, if you like. For me, I grew up in a middle-class Anglo-Celtic family in Launceston in northern Tasmania. If I met an Aboriginal person, I'm completely unaware that I did. Obviously, I would have done, but I was completely unaware of it. In 1991, I was the National Vice President of the Australian Medical Association. I was a walking encyclopedia on pretty much everything in the health area. And I was asked by a journalist, Karen Polglaze from AAP, to comment on ATSIC's environmental health policies. I said to her, I've got a patient with me, I'll call you back. I rang up AMA headquarters in Canberra, had a small army working on all sorts of health issues. I said to the guy that was running the whole public health program, I said, what's ATSIC? He told me. And I said, who have we got working on Aboriginal health? He said, nobody. That was my introduction to it in 1991, and I said very publicly at the National Press Club in 1993 as the National President of the AMA that I was very proud of what individual members of my profession had done for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, but I was ashamed of what the organised profession hadn't. And I spent much of my life from that time on doing everything I could to advance an understanding of the existential challenges facing Indigenous Australia. In terms of the voice, I supported the apology. I believed it was morally and politically the right thing to do, but it was extremely difficult for us. For half of my party room at the time, that they supported it, not a problem. 20% were happy to go with the leadership, and about 30% were anything from ambivalent through to totally opposed. So it was a job getting them there. I lost 4 on the day, but we got there. In terms of the voice, I think what's important here is that people need to know what is our constitution. This is like the hard drive. So the constitution, changing the constitution isn't something Australians don't do lightly for good reason. People need to educate themselves about what the constitution is, what it does, and then clearly there needs to be recognition of Indigenous Australians in the constitution. After the apology, by the way, I tried unsuccessfully to persuade Kevin Rudd to then let's do recognition in the Constitution. And he didn't want to do that. This proposal, The Voice, as we know, is to recognise our first Australians in the Constitution, but it is then also to have a voice which would speak specifically to the Parliament, to the Executive, the Government and so on. And people need to ask themselves whether they do believe that will advance the existential challenges of First Australians or not, and what consequences it's likely to have, positive and perhaps not so positive. But I haven't been speaking about it, and I'm not in a position to do so. I apologise to you for that.
Oh, that's fine, Brendan. Look, I'll be voting yes, but we're probably not up for the debate here because Limo's about to do a chat for his upcoming climate client. We've got to go.
But I do a quick one for you, Brendan, before we do go. On the Battle of Long Tan, from an artist's perspective, and this is such... as an artist, we're so self-involved and so into ourselves that we sometimes lose perspective of the outside world. Little Paddy, who I'm sure you know, was on stage as a 17-year-old girl in Vietnam when the Battle of Long Tan started. And she, little Paddy, was telling me the story, and she said that her first clue that something was going on is lots of troops were getting up and walking away from the performance. And when you're a performer, that's the last thing you want to see because you take it personally. So she said she was on stage thinking, they must hate me because they're all walking away and leaving. But of course, what was happening is they'd had word and they were moving off to the Battle of Long Tan. So yeah, it's 17-year-old little Paddy was actually on stage at the time.
Have you got time for me to tell you one little story that a lot of people wouldn't realise about this postscript for Long Tan?
Yeah, sure. I think so, yes. Yeah.
It's the Long Tan, it's the Long Tan Cross. And on the day of the Battle of Long Tan, the platoon sergeant for 10 Platoon was a man called Neil Rankin. He survived the battle. And then 3 years later, he was on his second tour in Vietnam, 1969, and the decision was made to construct a Long Tan cross and place it in the rubber plantation, which at that time in 69 was behind enemy lines. So Neil Rankin, he was chosen as the guy who would choose the site where the cross would be placed at Long Tan. So Neil Rankin told us in 2013, he said, I went out and he said, I looked for the 11 platoon position. He said, and with the heel of my boot, I marked the spot. He said, I wanted that cross to go into the soil drenched by the blood of young Australians from 11 platoon who died fighting for what they believed. 13 of those men of Bob Buick and Gordon Sharp's were killed at that spot on that day, and another 8 were wounded. And Neil Rankin said, because the cross is, of course, now in a beautiful chapel-like environment at the Australian War Memorial, Neil Rankin said, he said, when people look at that cross, I want them to look at it differently and to know that it was planted in the soil soaked in the blood of these young Australians. Just powerful stuff.
Extraordinary.
Extraordinary, Brendan. Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned your 5 artifacts in the War Memorial. That is the feature of the Howard Oration. And that is, I'm just going to play the 5 artifacts section of the Howard Oration as our feature speech. So thanks so much for joining us, Dr. Nelson. Really appreciate it.
Pleasure. Next time you've got to call me Brendan, though.
Oh, no worries, Brendan. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, guys.
Thank you, Brendan. Much appreciated.
Pleasure.
Cheers.
Bye.
This is the 50th episode of Speakola. And as I mentioned, you can support the show through patreon.com/Speakola or news.speakola.com. If you're not looking for a regular commitment, you can make one-off donations at speakola.com/donate. And if you just want to support Tony Wilson Creative Industries, you can buy one of my books. I've got an author website, TonyWilsonAuthor.com. Picture books there. Cow Tripped Over the Moon and Harry Highpants. There's a bit of a special on one of the Selwood Boys books. I've got my 1989 The Great Grand Final book, The Minister for Traffic Lights. There's a wide variety aimed at all sorts of genres and age groups. So that's TonyWilsonAuthor.com. The speech of the week, unsurprisingly, a Brendan Nelson speech. And there are plenty of good ones on YouTube to pick from. And he's actually given versions of the story that he delivered in our chat, in the interview. And there's one at the Press Club in 2017 for the 100-year anniversary of the campaign in France. He gave that speech as a director of the War Memorial, an excellent speech to look up on YouTube. But the speech I'm going to feature from Dr. Nelson is the John Howard Oration of 2021. I usually play the whole speech at the end of these episodes, but for this one, it's a very, very long speech. It's actually nearly an hour in length. So I'm just going to take the section that relates to Dr. Nelson's five most significant relics contained in the Australian War Memorial. The stuff that's really relevant to the chat that Dr. Nelson had with Limo and myself. And what is quite remarkable when you hear the speech is how similar it is to the way that Brendan told the story to us. And it shows a remarkable ability to learn a script. Dr. Nelson explained to us what he tried to bring to the job of being director of the War Memorial, to bring ordinary people's stories to the fore. And he certainly does that. And we hear one story we have heard before, and then we hear of the other four relics. So here is that speech of the week, and have a listen to Dr. Nelson's ability to master tone. He talked about trying to give people a feeling, and he does that with a certain musicality. There's a downbeat at the end of most sentences. It has an almost funereal aspect to it, and it's really quite beautiful and makes everyone cry. So here it is, speech of the week, Brendan Nelson.
The second precondition identified by Mill was that people must be bound, what he described, by a common fellow feeling. One, he said, deeply rooted in language, literature, and history. No place served to remind us more of who gave us what we have, made us who we are, than the Australian War Memorial. The late and great US Senator John McCain visited the memorial in May 2017. A one-hour visit turned into 2 hours. We stood before the tomb of the unknown Australian soldier. I told him, not a day goes by in this country where publicly or privately we do not give thanks for American sacrifice in the Pacific from December 1941 to the end of the war. 300,000 American casualties, 103,000 dead, half those bodies never found. We walked from the Hall of Memory, slowly, past the bronze panels, the names of 41,000 Australians killed, fighting with the United States in Europe, the Pacific, Korea, Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan. And then we stopped at the parapet of the memorial. And gesturing down Anzac Parade toward the Parliament, I said, Senator McCain, in that building, exercised and defended on our behalf, are our political, economic, and religious freedoms. But here, we reveal our character. We reveal our character as a people. Until you come here, I said to him, it's not possible to fully understand us, what makes us tick, and why we are an ally of the United States and we're not just good friends. The values informing our national character, I said to him, are found here. Our values are our interests. And he turned to me and said, and our interests are our values. The past is essential. It's vital to any understanding of the future. When little else makes sense, history is the guiding discipline. It leads to new horizons, it overcomes fear, and it can also inspire. Of the 2 million objects, artifacts in the Australian War Memorial's collection, five, in my opinion, speak most powerfully to our values. The first is the bullet-ridden Gallipoli landing boat from the transport ship Ascot. It took men of the 13th Battalion ashore on the day of the Gallipoli landings. A short distance from it is a painting by George Lambert, a painting of men, soldiers, falling as if marionettes, having had their strings cut. It depicts the charge of the Australian Light Horse at the Neck in the northern part of the Anzac sector in August 1915. At 4:30 in the morning, on the 7th of August 1915, four waves of dismounted light horse, 150 in each wave, would attack the Turks. Only 20 to 60 metres away. The first two waves were the 8th Light Horse from Victoria, the third and fourth, the 10th Light Horse, the Western Australians. The commanding officer of the 8th Light Horse was a man called Alexander Henry White, a 33-year-old maltster, a beer maker from Ballarat. He loved the men of the 8th, and he volunteered to lead them. Philip Schuller was the correspondent for the Melbourne Age, who observed and reported and recorded what he saw and what happened. And Schuller said that White shook hands with his fellow officers. He stood down in the trench on the fire step. The artillery bombardment of the Turkish lines had finished early, and much of it had gone over them. And then, with his watch in hand, as the Turks in the eerie silence tested machine guns and rifles, he said, "Men, you have 10 minutes to live, and I will lead you." Schuller said that when the whistle blew, they all went over, every one of them, and White advanced at only 10 paces before he fell. Of the 300 officers and men under White's command in those first two waves, 153 died with him. The 10th Light Horse from Western Australia filed into the trench over the dead, the dying and the wounded, having tried unsuccessfully to stop the attack progressing, by which time the Turks were calling out, "Don't come, don't come." Trooper Harold Rush famously embraced the man next to him, said, "Goodbye, God bless you, Cobber," which became the epitaph for his headstone. Then he and that man held hands on the parapet and said a prayer. Men removed their wedding rings, wrote final notes, pinned them to the inside of the trench. And when the whistle blew, they all went. And then in the fourth wave, the official historian Charles Beat described Gresley Harper running to his death as if a schoolboy in a foot race. At the end of the war, Charles Bean, the official correspondent, historian, decided not to come back to Australia immediately. Instead, he went back to Gallipoli, and he took a historical party with him, including George Lambert. And he found the Ascot landing boat on the beach and said it would come back to Australia for the Australian War Memorial he was determined would be built. And when they arrived at Lone Pine and the Neck, he described the area as resembling that of scattered thin white snow. So thickly clustered, he said, were the bones, it wasn't possible to pass without treading upon them. Around Alexander Henry White's skeletal remains were found two things he took to his death, clearly important to him. The first was a gold locket on a chain, within which was a photograph of his wife Myrtle and his infant son, whom he called Young Bill. The second was a Bible. And within that Bible was a newspaper cutting, a poem. "Let me be a little braver when temptation bids me waver. Let me strive a little harder to be all that I can be. Let me be a little meeker with the brother that is weaker. Let me think more of my neighbour and a little less of me." The second artefact is a nurse's uniform. Once white, now it's a pale shade of grey. It's fitted to a mannequin in the World War II galleries at the Australian War Memorial. There's a small hole, a bullet hole, in the left lower quadrant of the abdomen. The uniform belonged to a nurse, Vivian Bullwinkle, one of only 22 nurses to survive the massacre on Raji Beach, Banker Island, on the 16th of February 1942. Wounded, she survived by feigning death in the blood-stained water. having survived the sinking of the overloaded SS Viner Brook the day before. She and 21 nurses were on Raji Beach on the morning of the 16th, caring for 50 men. 20 Japanese soldiers arrived, bayonets fixed, and marched the men along the beach around a bluff. And as they did, one of the nurses, Matron Irene Drummond, said to the others, "Where there is life, there is hope." The soldiers bayoneted and shot the men. They returned to the nurses, set two machine guns up on the beach, and gestured for the nurses to go into the water. Florence Cosson had a fractured femur from the sinking of the ship, so Irene Drummond and another nurse helped her to the water's edge. Bullwinkle said there was no panic, no hysteria. All they did was call the names of those whom they loved. And shortly before she, Cosson and the other nurse were machine gunned, Irene Drummond said, "Chins up, girls. I'm proud of you. I love you all." In life, she offered them hope. In death, she offered them love. The third artifact is G for George, the four-engine Lancaster bomber. 10,000 young Australians, average age 24, served in Bomber Command. 3,486 dead. That aircraft remarkably survived 89 missions, returning twice on two engines, engine failure on takeoff on one occasion with a full bomb load. On the 23rd of August 1943, 56 bombers were shot down over Berlin. One was a four-engine Halifax bomber from 158 Squadron. The pilot was a 21-year-old Australian, Kevin Hornibrook. A German night fighter got them just after they left the bomb site. With the aircraft in a death dive, the two Australian gunners, 20 and 21, dead. Three of the crew had bailed out. There was only one other man left in the plane, the bomb aimer, a Yorkshireman called Alan Bright. And Alan Bright said that against immense gravitational forces, Kevin Hornibrook got to the forward hatch and forced it open. And he said, "Kevin never got out. We'd been too low. My life hinged on that moment when Kevin pushed me out. When my son was born in 1951, I called him Kevin to remind me every single day of Kevin Hornibrook, to whom I owed the rest of my life. Never a day goes by without me remembering that he was first at the door and could easily have saved himself, but he saved me." In 2017, for the 75th anniversary of the Royal Australian Air Force going into Bomber Command formally, we conducted a major event at the Australian War Memorial. We had 37 Bomber Command veterans come. A week before the event, I received a phone call from a woman in Albany, Western Australia. She said her father, 95 as he was a veteran of Bomber Command, and would it be possible for him to get in the aircraft when he came to the memorial, the Lancaster? I wasn't sure. I found out and I was told it was. So on the Friday morning before the weekend activities, we'd set up for the media to come and cover him visiting the aircraft, which he had flown once on a mission. Murray Maxton had flown 30 missions in Bomber Command as a pilot. And there he was sitting in the aircraft on a bulkhead. You'd never complain about flying economy to London again, by the way. He was wearing his suit, extensive array of medals, and my staff and his daughter had decided it was too dangerous for him to get over the spar in the centre of the aircraft to get to the cockpit where he so desperately wanted to be. And I looked at him and I said, "Murray, would I be thinking, if you fell over and broke your neck and died, getting over that spar, you'd die a happy man." And he said, yep. And I said, okay, mate, we're going to do it. He spent 15 minutes in the cockpit of that aircraft, the media filming and photographing from the mezzanine level. And then outside the aircraft beside it, he held a captivating press conference to a very, very large media contingent. And then silence fell on the entire gathering when a young journalist from the ABC asked, well, that all sounds very interesting, Mr. Maxton, but how did you feel about the civilians that were killed? He replied by saying, I was in London during the Blitz. We'd heard rumours about what they were doing to the Jews. And then he gestured to the bomber behind him. He said, for a period of time, the only way we had of getting to Hitler was in these aircraft. He said, you've never been in total war. I hope you never are. But I'll give you some advice. You don't want to come second. The fourth relic is the Long Tan Cross. On the 18th of August, 1966, D Company 6RAR fought an overwhelming force of Viet Cong and North Vietnamese army, and they prevailed. 17 Australians were killed in that rubber plantation, and 18th would die of his wounds. Alan Rankin was the platoon sergeant that day from 10 Platoon. And 3 years later, in 1969, he was in Vietnam again. The decision had been made to construct and place a cross behind enemy lines at Long Tan. And Alan Rankin was tasked with deciding where the cross would be placed. And he told us in 2013, he said, I looked for the 11 platoon position under the command of Gordon Sharp and Bob Buick. They had the first and second contacts, taking 50 cal machine gun fire at ground level. Of the 28 men in 11 platoon at Long Tan, 13 were killed, 8 were wounded. And Alan said, with the heel of my boot, I marked the spot where the cross was to be erected. I knew it was the blood of that platoon. When people look at that Long Tan cross, I want them to know that it stood in blood-soaked earth where so many young men paid the ultimate price for what they believe. The fifth object is the cowling from a US Black Hawk helicopter. In 2010, in Kandahar, a US Black Hawk helicopter crashed in a Special Forces insertion operation. 3 Australian commandos were killed, Tim Aplin, Ben Chuck, and Scott Palmer. On the 6th of August 2013, after formalities for the opening of the Afghanistan exhibition, I was standing in front of the cowling with Mrs. Pam Palmer. It had been used as a stretcher to bring out our dead, including her son. She wrapped her arms around me, buried her face in my shoulder, and wept uncontrollably and said, thank you for making my son's life mean something and his memory live. To the dawn service the following April at the memorial, Royal Australian Air Force nurse, Wing Commander Sharon Bowne, who led a surgical team in Afghanistan, concluded her reflections by saying, I have worn their blood. So many of us have worn their blood. Everyone is regarded as being equal at the Australian War Memorial. In death, especially. No rank, no military honours, no race, no religion, and no party politics. But within that framework of equality is accorded a special place for the first Australians. Just 4 or 5 generations after the first fleet arrived, with everything that they endured, in 1914, they denied their Aboriginality, denied family, denied kinship, from a desperately unequal Australia, to volunteer, serve, fight, suffer, and die for the young country that had taken so much from them.
That's it for the episode. Thank you so much, Brendan Nelson, for coming on Speakola, for being part of our 50th. Brendan mentioned he's released a book called Of Life and Leadership. That's out through Connor Court Publishing, connorcourtpublishing.com.au. Thank you to Limo, both for the tip-off and for the participation. You're a good man with a good ear for a speech. You can book Limo to be the MC at your next corporate gig through ICMI and such bureaus. And if you're not going to get Limo, get me. I do that job as well and have for 25 years. I'm getting good at it. If you want to help Speakola, I mentioned it off the top, but please leave us a rating or a review or a birthday message at the iTunes Speakola podcast page. A 5-star rating would be nice. I don't have any sponsors on this podcast at the moment, so if you'd like to donate, it's speakola.com/donate. And you might want to subscribe on Patreon or through the Substack, news.speakola.com. Thanks for being part of the 50th. I'll be back with 51 shortly.
Just before he deployed to Vietnam, Private Gant had gone into a recording studio and recorded this song for his mother. The audio that you're about to hear is more than 50 years old.
Annie boy, the pipes are calling. From glen to glen and down the mountainside, the summer's gone and all the roses falling. It's you must go, and I nor come he back when summer's in the meadow, or when the valley's hung all white with snow. It's Irish here in sunshine or in shadow. Oh, Danny boy, oh, Danny boy, I love you so. But come he back when summer's in the meadow, or when the valley's hard, all white with snow. It's I'll be here in sunshine or in shadow. Oh, Danny boy, oh, Danny boy, I love you so.
Private Gant's name is listed on the roll of honour on my left, among more than 500 Australians from the Vietnam War. His photograph is displayed today beside the Pool of Reflection. This is but one of many stories of service and sacrifice told here at the Australian War Memorial. We now remember Private Kenneth Howard Gant, who gave his life for us, for our freedoms, and in the hope of a better world.